मनोबुद्ध्यहङ्काररचितानि नाहं न च श्रोत्रजिह्वेन च घ्राणनेत्रे न च व्योमभूमिन तेजो न वायु चिदानन्दरूप शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं चिदानन्दरूप शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं न च प्राणसंज्ञो न वै पञ्चवायु न वा सप्तधातु न वा पञ्चकोशा न वा पाणिपादं न चोपस्थपायु चिदानन्दरूप शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं चिदानन्दरूप शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं न मे द्वेषरागौ लोभमोहौ मदो नैव मे नैव मात्सर्यभाव न धर्मो न चार्थो न कामो न मोक्ष चिदानन्दरूप शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं चिदानन्दरूप शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं न पुण्यं न पापं न सौख्यं न दुःखम् न मन्त्रो न तीर्थं न वेदा न यज्ञा अहं भोजनं नैव भोज्यं न भोक्ता चिदानन्दरूपा शिवोऽहं चिदानन्दरूप शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं अहं निर्विकल्पो निराकाररूपो विभूत्वाच्च सर्वत्र सर्वेन्द्रियाणां न चासङ्गतं नैव मुक्तेर्न मे चिदानन्दरूप शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं चिदानन्दरूप शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं चिदानन्दरूप शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं चिदानन्दरूप
नैव Welcome to our third class of the Splendid Path, and welcome to the grace field of Guru Purnima, which I know, as many of you have been sharing, we've been experiencing all day. We've been listening, as we always do at the beginning of class, to the six stanzas on Nirvana, written by Adi Shankaracharya, who was one of the great gurus of the Indian non-dual tradition. And I just want to quote the translation of two of these verses. I'm neither the conscious nor the unconscious mind, neither intelligence nor ego, neither the senses of smell and sight, nor the ears nor the tongue. I am neither ether nor air nor fire nor water nor solidity. I am consciousness and bliss. I am Shiva. I am Shiva. I am without form, without thought. I pervade everywhere, yet I am beyond all senses. I am neither detachment nor liberation nor anything that can be measured. I am consciousness and bliss. I am Shiva. I am Shiva. You notice how these verses essentially deconstruct all the different things we hook our identity on normally. So to understand yourself as without thought, without form, without senses, is actually to let go of being the person that you normally think you are. And of course, this is profoundly counterintuitive for us when we are in our normal human state of consciousness. In fact, it doesn't even necessarily sound possible. Yet this is how the great beings tell us they experience themselves. And it's precisely why the first book of the Shiva Sutras starts the way it does with the statement Chaitanyam Atma, because what Shiva is describing in these sutras, especially the first 22 sutras of Book 1, what he's describing is not only his own experience, God's experience, he's also describing the highest state of enlightenment, which is the state of the Guru, which is the state that we're celebrating on Guru Purnima. For those of you who aren't versed in Indian holidays, the Guru Purnima means the full moon dedicated to the Guru. In the West, it's called the buck moon, I think referring to the buck rabbit. But in India and in Tibet and perhaps in other places of the world, it's the day we honor teachers. All teachers, but especially those teachers who show us the path to knowing the self, the path to enlightened consciousness, the path of truth. And as all the great beings have told us, that includes honoring the enlightened consciousness within each one of us, the enlightenment within ourselves, because the guru is not just a human being, or certainly not only a human being. The guru is the liberating function within the supreme consciousness, what the Pratyabhigna Hridayam calls the grace-bestowing power of God, the Anugraha Shakti, which is one of the fundamental acts that consciousness performs at every moment. So it's that act of revelation, of recognition, that is the guru. So as we chant and meditate, which we're just about to do, let's do it with the recognition that it's our own inner guru we honor. Because in the tantric traditions, even though there is enormous honor paid to the human teacher, the deep honor really is to that quality in the self that has been leading us and guiding us lifetime after lifetime in order to bring us to the place where we are ready to know the truth, not only for a moment or two, but in a permanent way, in a way that doesn't leave us. In the Guru Gita, the Guru is described like this. Salutations to the Guru, who is awareness, eternal, peaceful, pure, beyond space and time, who pervades the universe and who grants worldly fulfillment as well as liberation. Find your heart space. Find your posture first. Let yourself be grounded through the sit bones and let the torso rise up from that base through the crown. Inhale and feel that the inhalation draws your attention to the base of the posture, grounding, feeling your connection to the seat and to the earth. Exhaling, feel how the torso rises upward. And then let your attention with the inhalation come into the space behind the breastbone. Sometimes it's helpful to put your palm over your breastbone just to locate your awareness. And feel that space behind the chest towards the back of the heart as the seat of your soul, as well as one of the primary seats within which we can experience Guru. And be aware that all of us, everyone here on this call, and everyone who's tuning into it tomorrow or next week, that every one of us is connected, connected through the power of this profound surge of awareness, which we're going to be talking about today, connected as part of this sangham, this community. And as you touch into your own heart, become present to the circle of souls. And imagine yourself lighting your candle and placing it in the center of the circle. Now we'll chant our mantras, the mantras to Ganesha, the Shiva mantras, the Mahamrityunjaya mantra, the invocation to Shiva as the Guru, and the invocation to the primordial goddess, who is herself the grace-bestowing power. And we'll chant each of these mantras three times, and then I'll give you some instructions and we'll sit for a few minutes in closed-eyed meditation.
Om Ganganapataye Namaha. Om Ganganapataye Namaha. Om Ganganapataye Namaha. Vakratunda Mahakaya Koti Surya Samaparabha Nirvignam Guru Kurume Deva Sarva Karyeshu Sarvada. Vakratunda Mahakaya Koti Surya Samaprabha Nirvignam Kurume Deva Sarva Karyeshu Sarvada. Vakratunda Mahakaya Koti Surya Samaprabha Nirvignam Kurume Deva Sarva Karyeshu Sarvada. Om Trayambakam Yajamahe Sugandhim Pushtivardhanam Urvarukamiva Bandhanan Mrityor Mukshiyam Amritat. Om Trayambakam Yajamahe Sugandhim Pushtivardhanam Urvarukamiva Bandhanan Mrityor Mukshiyam Amritat. Om Trayambakam Yajamahe Sugandhim Pushtivardhanam Urvarukamiva Bandhanan Mrityor Mukshiyam Amritat. Om. Gurave sarvalokanam pisaje bhavaroginam nidhaye sarvavidyanam dakshinamurtaye namaha. Gurave sarvalokanam pisaje bhavaroginam nidhaye sarvavidyanam Dakshina Murtaye Namaha. Gurave Sarvalokanam Pisaje Bhavaroginam Nidhaye Sarvavidyanam Dakshina Murtaye Namaha.
I bow to the Guru of all worlds, to the physician who cures all worldly ills, to the ocean of all wisdom, to Dakshinamurti Shiva, the Lord who initiates us into the truth. And finally, the invocation to the primordial goddess.
Sarva Mangala Mangalye Shive Sarvatra Sarike Sharanye Trayambake Gauri Narayani Namostute. Sarva Mangala Mangalye Shive Sarvatra Sadike Sharanye Trayambake Gauri Narayani Namostute. Sarva Mangala Mangalye Shive Sarvatra Sadike Sharanye Trayambake Gauri Narayani Namostute.
Your eyes are closed. Your posture is grounded. And your attention flows between the sensations that you're aware of in your physical body. The feeling of weight, the weight of your buttocks against the seat. The light pressure of your clothing. The feeling of the air against your skin, the feeling of the temperature of the air. The sensations of your hair on your head. The feelings of tightness or holding in certain parts of your body. The sensation of your upper eyelids resting against the lower eyelids. The sounds, not only the sound of my voice, the ambient sounds around you, let yourself relax in the simple experience of this moment, its sensations. It sounds the feeling of the breath as it caresses your nostrils on the inhalation, following the breath down the throat, in through the nasal passages, following the exhalation as it flows. Notice how the residual moods of the day might still be present, and you can also be aware of those. As you let your attention cycle through sensations, sounds, the felt sense of breath, the recognition of the inner experience of thinking, feeling, mood, notice how all these experiences are held in awareness. And allow the experience of awaring, because of course, being aware is not an object of awareness. It's not a noun. It's a process. Let that awaring, that faculty of attention, resolve back into its source, which is the ever-present awaring. That according to Shiva is both your deepest self and also Shiva Shakti. So just let yourself hold and cycle through all the different aspects of your experience. Including the feeling of aliveness of vitality, the dynamic feeling of your body, the edges of your body meeting the air. Including the little tickles, including the fact that some of you may be swaying slightly, that feeling of moving. Including the experience of the breath deepening as you pay attention to it. Including that ability to focus, which is letting your attention cycle. And then again, just opening up to awareness itself. To the simple feeling of being that actually holds all these different aspects of experience. And let's seal it with the thought, I am that awareness. That awareness is me. That awareness is the source of life. That awareness is what we call God, not the mythic God who lives in the sky, but God as that creative intelligence that is present as the source of life. So what we're doing in these classes as we train ourselves to stay present with awareness, not just in meditation, but during our walking around life, and I know that we're not always aware of awareness, and we're not always remembering to be aware of awareness, but every time that we do, every time that we ask ourselves one of those profound inquiry questions, we're practicing enlightenment. And I use this phrase very deliberately because I've found in my own experience that one of the main breakthroughs for me in sadhana was to recognize that enlightenment is something that you can practice even if you're not in an enlightened state at this particular moment. You know, we tend to believe that enlightenment, enlightened consciousness, is only for rare, gifted, let's say, virtuous people who attain it only after lifetimes of sadhana. And we tend to believe that even when we know better, even when we are very spiritually educated, as so many of you are, you know, we kind of assume that to experience enlightened states takes a long time, that it's a matter of extreme grace, that you either have it or you don't. And even though it's true that the experience of awakening, the experience of enlightenment, is not under our control, nonetheless, it is something we can practice, and it's not hubristic, and it's not faking to practice these understandings, these enlightened phrases that we're working with. It's not faking it to tune into your ordinary, common, or garden variety awareness. I actually love that phrase. I heard it from Adyashanti. Your ordinary garden variety awareness, he says, is the enlightened state of awareness. And this is actually the fundamental thing that we are looking at and that the Shiva Sutras is looking at. So practicing enlightenment is not the same thing as pretending to be enlightened. It's actually a form of self-cultivation. And remember the sage of the Shiva Sutras, who, if you're to believe what the text says about itself, is none other than Shiva, than God himself, so to speak. The sages of Kashmir Shaivism firmly believed, because it was their experience, that since human consciousness is not intrinsically different than the ultimate consciousness, when we cultivate enlightened attitudes, we're actually being who we are. You know, that was their firm conviction. And in fact, Sutra 17 of the Shiva Sutras actually says this. The sutra says, firm conviction of your identity with Shiva is knowledge of the self. In other words, if your conviction of your own divinity is unshakable, you can be said to be a self-realized person. And this is what a true guru is, a sadguru, the highest form of guru, is a human being who has that firm conviction. But that firm conviction is actually inside us as well. And we periodically fall into it, or let's say it emerges. And that's what we're going to be talking about in our class today, as we talk about Sutra 5. For me, the two parts, the two aspects of this particular sadhana of practicing enlightenment is, first of all, over and over and over again throughout the day, to insist to myself that this is a good moment to recognize my awareness is Shiva. This room that I'm experiencing, this garden that I'm experiencing, this conversation that I'm in the midst of, all of that is being held and vitalized by awareness, which permeates every aspect of experience and which is not different than the creative consciousness we call Shiva Shakti. And that as we do this, while at the same time, and this is really important, while at the same time asking awareness to reveal itself, asking Goddess to give us the grace to know the truth about ourselves, to experience the truth about ourselves, those two aspects of, you know, the jnana yoga practice, because that's what it is, to be firm in insisting my awareness is God's awareness, and to keep praying to be shown it. That is, not to fool yourself that just because you're thinking it means you're experiencing it. Knowing that you actually need some help from the heart of the universe to have that experience be real. And as you work with these two modalities, over time, the Shakti that has taken form as your mind, as the Matrika Shakti, will reverse its outgoing tendency, will turn back on itself and start to show you this truth that you've been practicing. And really, the Shiva Sutras are a textual expression of the primordial guru. The words themselves, as so many of you are experiencing, will sooner or later shed the experience. And even though at first we're going, oh, I don't understand a word of this, because these sutras are very cryptic, as you keep asking, as you keep reading them again and again with the intention to allow yourself to be shown what the sutras are talking about, they start to become real. They start to become experience. And what you're always doing as you read these sutras and as we have these conversations and as you meditate with this particular understanding and talk to your partners, what we're doing is injecting enlightened ideas into our consciousness so that they can soften the conditioning that makes us experience ourselves as limited, that makes us see the world as outside us, when in fact, nothing is outside us. So I'd like to just talk for a couple of minutes before we really get into the sutra about what the mind of an enlightened being seems to be like, what the mind of a sage really reveals. Modern sages like Ramana Maharshi and Nisargadatta Maharaj spoke a lot about what the experience of non-dual enlightenment felt like to them. And so did my guru, Swami Muktananda. There were differences, slight differences in the way they described it. Muktananda, for example, very often talked about his vision of the world as, you know, a constant arising of forms inside a delicate blue radiance, which he described as the radiance of the self. Ramana Maharshi and Nisargadatta very rarely used visual words, but essentially they were talking about the same state. And what they were describing, of course, was what the sutras are pointing to. So here are some of the qualities that enlightened beings demonstrate, which we could say are qualities of enlightened awareness. So first, each of them primarily identified as awareness itself rather than as a body. Second, each of them understood and profoundly respected the fact that thought is largely creating our experience of the world. In other words, that our inner state is the filter through which we see, hear, and touch everything that we experience as the world we inhabit. Third, they were never bamboozled by mental ideas, at least not for long. I know that knowing Swami Muktananda, he had a lot of opinions, and he was very strong about his opinions. But you would see how, you know, if he expressed an opinion, or even a very intense, strong opinion, he held it so lightly that he could drop it in a second. He experienced thoughts and opinions not only as passing phenomena, but as aspects of Shakti's creative play as Matrika. And he used to say, all ideas are made of awareness. Even the worst thought, even the most painful suffering thought, is made of awareness. Fourth, these sages were incredibly happy. In other words, they found life easy and joyous, and it wasn't because their lives were that easy. Every one of them went through very tough times. Ramana famously had a tumor removed without anesthetic because he could stay blissful, basically, even in great pain. My guru described the same thing. And they didn't, none of these beings resisted unpleasant situations, even though they had no problem standing up for justice and fair play and truth. But they also knew how to negotiate the seams of reality so that pathways opened up for them. They accepted themselves as they are, as they were, with all their personal eccentricities. And they accepted others as well, so that being around them made you feel deeply loved. And another characteristic that they all shared, and that at least as far as I have been able to determine all enlightened beings share, is that they were devotional. They loved the Shakti, the divinity. The reality to them was not kind of a bare, dry witness, but a scintillating, vibrating, loving field within which everything that emerged and arose was a dance. And They were humble, but never wimpy. They were self-confident, but never arrogant. And these are just a few of the qualities that we start to notice in ourselves. And this is really important. We start to notice these qualities emerging in ourselves, maybe just mildly in the beginning, but little by little, they start to become our felt experience of life. So the Shiva Sutras, which is actually offering us a map of what enlightenment is like from the highest point of view to the point of view of someone who's actually in the process, as we are, of doing sadhana, they always started with the highest point of view by describing truth from the ultimate experience of consciousness. And they did this before they gave practical meditation instructions and also before they gave ethical prescriptions. And, you know, one of the questions that people from other traditions often ask about the Eastern masters, and especially the Tantric masters, you know, is there a place for ethics in non-dual consciousness, which often doesn't talk so much about, you know, what to do, what to say, how to act. And one reason that they don't, although if you get to know the writings and the teachings of any one of these sages, you see that there are always deep ethical teachings in their day-to-day conversation. But basically, what they wanted to establish was that non-duality is the basis of ethics. In other words, it doesn't really work to say do unto others as you would have them do unto you without getting who you are and who the others are. Because if you understand that everyone and everything is a part of yourself, then it's very natural to be kind, to be helpful, to be equal-minded, you know, because you are experiencing everything as part of a single divine fabric of reality. Catherine's experience that she shared in the listserv of recognizing that so-called inanimate objects actually have souls, you know, is one of the ways that we start to recognize that there is actual consciousness in everything. The other reason that the Shiva Sutras starts with the highest vision is because the sages hoped that you would be able to get it just by hearing it. And in that sense, these sutras are speaking to the self beyond the mind. You know, the mind can't grasp this stuff. I mean, we can intellectually understand it if we study it, but it's only the self, it's only consciousness itself that can recognize what Shiva is talking about here. Awareness knows itself. At the deepest level, because you are awareness, you know that you are consciousness and bliss, which is why when you hear the Nirvana Shatakama, when you read the commentaries on the sutra, something in you goes, yes. So what the Shiva Sutras are doing is what in Buddhism is called a pointing out instruction. And of course, there in contemporary Western spirituality, there are many different teachers who use this method. Even though they may not say your awareness is God, a teacher like Rupert Spira or Francis Lucille or Adyashanti or some of the Dzogchen teachers of Tibetan Buddhism will keep pointing your attention to awareness, and at least for the duration of a meditation can often transmit that awareness to you. And this is basically the method we've been using words, matrika, to point beyond words. And, you know, as many of you know, Ramana Maharshi and his disciples call this the direct path, the path in which we just cut right to the chase. Awareness is God. Focus on your awareness. Let the thoughts and words come and go. Just be that which you really are. And this, of course, invites awareness to rise up from its background position and take over. The sutras that we're going to be practicing with today, Sutra 5 and Sutra 7, really speak to this truth, to this point. Sutra 5, I'm going to give you the Sanskrit, says Udyamo Bhairavaha. I love this, the sound of this. Udyamo Bhairavaha. What it literally means is upsurge is God. And upsurge is God, and that this phrase, Udyamo Bhairavaha, it has a, you know, it feels like an upsurge. The way in which this very cryptic sutra is usually explained is that the upsurge that we're talking about as God is the upsurge of awakened awareness. The upsurge, the experience of awakening. One of the great poetic Shaivite sages, whose name is Maheshwarananda, has a beautiful poetic phrase. He calls this the emergence of the splendor. The emergence of the splendor. You know, your awareness is splendor. You know, it's like those magnificent sunsets in which, you know, the sky is completely emblazoned with golden light and rosy colored clouds, and you're just going, oh my God, you know, this is an experience of natural splendor, and it's awe-inspiring. So the emergence of the splendor is the upsurge of the recognition, oh my God, I am Shiva, I am awareness. And the seventh sutra, which we'll also be talking about today, explains what happens when that emergent splendor actually becomes your normal daily experience. And that sutra, Sutra 7, I'm going to give you the Sanskrit, Jagat Swapna Shushupt Bhede Turiya Bhoga Sambhavaha. It means that the radiance of divine consciousness is present in the form of awareness, even during the ordinary states of waking, dreaming, and deep sleep. And again, we'll unpack that a little bit later. So Udyamo Bhairavaha is, you know, it's the great aha. The, you know, in Buddhism they say, in Zen they say, emyoho, you know, aho, you know, because they believe that you can't express this in ordinary words. It's like, it's a Udyamo Bhairavaha, aha. Upsurge is God. And I want to say, because it's always possible with these sutras to look at them from a more, I call it user-friendly position. In other words, you can look at this sutra as a description of the deep inner significance of certain experiences that come to us as part of our daily life, one of which is the upsurge of insight or intuition. You know, those moments when you suddenly you go, oh my God, the answer to this problem that has been keeping me awake for weeks, it suddenly just kind of surges up from nowhere. It's not like I thought of it, it just arose. Or, you know, the upsurge of a feeling of tremendous love. Or, you know, the moment when a creative inspiration arises and you just, you know, you all of a sudden a poem is coming through you and it's all you can do to get it down. You know, these are experiences of Udyamo. And if you really understand the basic teachings of this tradition, those too are experiences of Bhairava. Because remember, God as awareness underlies all your states, as Sutra 7 says. The radiance of pure eye consciousness is present as awareness while you're awake and thinking, while you're asleep and dreaming, and while you're in deep sleep. It's just that we're not normally aware of it. But in the ultimate sense, you know, the let's say, highest meaning of this sutra is, as Kshemaraja, the great commentator, says in his commentary on the verse, the upsurge of highest awareness is the sudden emergence of the highest level of intuition, the outpouring of consciousness in the form of all-pervasive self-awareness. In other words, if we want to talk, you know, the kind of ultimate experience of the flashing forth of reality is a recognition, essentially, that one awareness pervades everything. That said, anytime you feel a shift of state from a state of contraction to a state of openness, freedom, and expansiveness and love, you are experiencing Bhairava. So I just want to say a little bit about Bhairava. In the Indian tradition, there are thousands of names for the highest awareness, for God, for the Absolute, including at least 1,000 for God in the form of Shiva. And Bhairava is a particularly fierce and active form of Shiva. The mythological story about Bhairava is that, you know, back in the mists of antiquity, Shiva committed a big sin, which I won't go into at the moment, and feels like he has to do penance for it. So he takes on this form called Bhairava, which is, you know, the form of a naked beggar, and wanders as an outcast living in graveyards and cremation grounds. So Bhairava, Shiva in the Bhairava form, is completely outside the bonds of society and doesn't obey ordinary social norms. And the, you know, the fact that the sutra uses this particular name actually points to the fact, it's not an accident, it points to the fact that this sudden surging of enlightenment is utterly outside the ordinary, even outside civilization itself. So, you know, it's beyond all laws, it's beyond all customs. It doesn't, you know, this kind of emergence, the Udhimo Bhairavaha, pays no attention to whether you're a good person, to whether you're mature or immature. It's utterly free. So, you know, and because it transcends all rules and categories. So it's something that has often been misunderstood. It has to really be seen in its correct context. But the deepest reality is that the truth doesn't care about good manners, doesn't care about how you're supposed to act. It really doesn't care whether you're a good person. It just sweeps in and takes over. Hopefully, you know, your ethics catches up with your realization. And it's also true that the practice that you do, the sadhana that you do, is what's going to allow you to hold on to this experience and cultivate it. And, you know, we will tend to interpret such peak experiences according to our stage of spiritual maturity. And it's, in other words, if you're, you know, if, for example, you're a fundamentalist Christian or Muslim, if you have such an experience, you know, I know some people who, you know, who have had this experience. Actually, I'm going to tell you a friend's experience. One of my friends, who's actually a fellow disciple of my guru's, when he had his first awakening, which was a radical surging of blissful awareness that just upended all of his ideas about reality. And if, you know, when he came out of that, you know, that wordless, vast moment and started to try to make sense of it with his matrika, what he decided was that he must be Jesus. I mean, he literally decided that, you know, that he was having the experience of being Jesus, and he thought, oh, maybe I'm an incarnation of Jesus. He said he felt very fortunate that he didn't tell anybody else about it, because, of course, that's a sure way to get put into an institution. It certainly was in those days, in the early 60s, the late 60s when this happened to him. So Udyama Bhairavaha can happen to anybody at any time in any state of meditation. It can happen in closed-eyed meditation, and it can also happen in open-eyed states, you know, where boundaries disappear, and you have a recognition that your awareness is everywhere. My first experience of this happened when I was 10, and it wasn't that forms dissolved. It was a small experience by the standards of Ramana Maharshi, but it was utterly radical for me. And I'm going to tell you how it happened. I was with a group of kids in my neighborhood, and it was night, and we were in someone's living room playing this game of enhanced hide and seek that we called murder. And in the game of murder, you turn off all the lights, you draw slips of paper. One person draws a slip that identifies them as the murderer, and then you turn off the lights, and everyone sort of surges around the room, and the murderer finds a victim, pretends to strangle them. The victim falls down on the ground, and then screams, the lights go on, and then everyone tries to figure out who the murderer was. So we were in the dark. I was moving around the room. I wasn't the murderer. And then without warning, this incredible loving presence just surged up, filled the room, and I could feel that it was not just me, but it was in everybody. It was overwhelmingly ecstatic. It was a little bit like the experience that Nina described on the listserv. And it was remarkable that, you know, I certainly wasn't in meditation. I didn't know about meditation. But it was completely clear to me in that moment that this was the truth, that everything was one great, loving, peaceful, invisible, creative presence. I had no framework for understanding it. Years later, I read a book by C.S. Lewis, the author of the Narnia Chronicles, who is also a Christian theologian and mystic. He wrote a book called Surprised by Joy, in which he describes his own direct experiences of God as this kind of arising of pure, unbearably blissful happiness and love. As I say, I had no words for it, though I really tried to describe it. I was, you know, it's the poet Kabir says, when it's like a mute person trying to describe the taste of sugar, all you can do is go blah 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 blah, because you just can't find words. So again, this is how Kshema Raja describes it in the commentary. The upsurge of highest awareness is the sudden emergence of the highest form of intuition, the outpouring of consciousness in the form of all-pervasive self-awareness. It is Bhairava because it holds the entire universe, and because in this surge all sense of difference is assimilated into consciousness. This uprising is itself Bhairava, because Bhairava holds within himself the entire universe by devouring the entire mass of ideation, which creates the sense of difference. So the next time you have an opening, even if it's not the fullest possible opening, remember to recognize it's Bhairava. I'm going to tell you another experience, which was the first experience that I had of the actual dissolution of forms into consciousness, which it was an early Shaktipat moment, one of my first meditation retreats with my guru. And I was sitting in meditation with about 200 other people in a dark room, and all of a sudden the world disappeared. It literally dissolved. It was like the world got sucked into my awareness, and there were no forms. There was nothing else. I I knew, don't ask me how, but it was one of those, you know, meditative convictions. I knew with total conviction that there's only one substance in the universe and that it's all inside me, that it's all awareness, and that awareness is me. And I was unprepared for this experience. It wasn't even something I was longing for at the time. So my first reaction was a kind of existential loneliness. Oh my God, is this true? Is it all just me? Am I alone in the universe? And as I was, you know, kind of resisting this opening, suddenly the whole field of my awareness was filled with indescribable love. I mean, really big love, and I've had some experiences of love. It was as though the two aspects of the ultimate reality, awareness and love, Shiva and Shakti, came together in that moment. And instead of being, you know, normally our awareness is mixed up with our ideation, with our mind. You know, we are aware, but awareness is so mediated by our intellect and by our thought stream that it's hard to pick out the purity of it. And in the same way, love is so mixed up with emotions, with attachment, that it's hard to really feel what love is. This is a moment in which awareness and love reveal themselves as the whole universe. And this experience, as I say, can happen with your eyes open. In fact, someone just told me that that he was in a satsang with Maharishi Mahesh Yogi, the founder of TM, many years ago. And when someone asked if you can experience the state that Maharishi called God consciousness in the waking state, and Maharishi said yes. If you've ever come out of meditation and seen that the world looked soft, that the world had a shimmer, has a shimmer to it, you know, the forms are there, but you can feel the intrinsic aliveness and divinity in it, you're having an open-eyed experience of God consciousness. We can see God in the world with open eyes if we're willing to recognize it. So, Udyamal Bhairavaha, let's just take another moment and turn our awareness inside. One of the main practices for cultivating the experience of Bhairava, of awakened awareness, is to replicate the way great beings move through the world. It's actually a practice called Bhairavi Mudra. And it's not a mudra that you do with your hands. It's an attitude. So, and the attitude is this, I'm going to explain it and then we're going to do it. So in Bhairavi Mudra, you begin by really bringing your awareness deeply internal. You bring your awareness into the heart, or into the Sushumna Nadi, or into the Sahasrara, and you allow yourself to become fully immersed in meditation. And then you open your eyes, keeping your awareness in the heart. And by heart here, we mean the heart as the heart is, in Kashmir Shaivism, it's a word for God. The heart means Shiva. The heart means God. It means the center of everything, the source. And one doorway into the heart, into the great heart, is through the heart center in the body. So I like to use my heart as my main place of rest and meditation. So we're going to do this practice with awareness in the heart center. But then you open your eyes, as I said, and keeping your attention in the heart, you begin to breathe with the feeling that with the inhalation, you draw the room or the garden or the view out your window. You view the forms that you can see with open eyes. You draw them into the heart. And then with the exhalation, you imagine those forms flowing out of the heart. So you are literally creating a congruence between your inner heart space and the so-called outside world. We're going to do this practice in a couple of sequential gestures. So you can re-center yourself in your posture. And take a few deep breaths. And let the next inhalation bring your awareness behind the breastbone. And inhaling, begin to feel as though your breath is drawing your attention towards the back of the heart and then through the back of the heart. I find that it's much easier to, at least for me, and I think for many of you, to make the connection between the heart, your own heart center, and the big heart, the vast heart, if you let yourself meditate on the heart behind the body. Because, of course, our subtle body is actually much bigger than our physical body. And the heart, the subtle heart, is at least 3 feet wider than the body and can be entered through the breath most easily if you center your attention in what I call the back heart. So inhaling, feel that the breath draws your awareness through the breastbone, through the back, and begin to open to the sense of a heartful presence at your back. And then exhaling, feel that presence beginning to fill your physical and subtle bodies. Allowing yourself to soften into that experience. Don't worry about whether you're getting it right or whether you're really in the back heart or whether this is all a fantasy. Just allow the breath to draw your awareness into the subtle center behind the body. And let the exhalation flow in such a way that the exhalation actually deepens your relaxation, deepens your sense of softening into the heart. And we'll just sit in the heart like this for a moment or two. Now with great intentionality, make the decision that you're going to station your sense of self, your what Don Juan of the Castaneda books called your assemblage point, that is the place where you feel most yourself. Have the intention that you are stationing yourself in the open space of the back heart. And then keeping your awareness indrawn, open your eyes. Now with the inhalation, feel that you're drawing everything that appears in your vision into the heart. Obviously, this isn't happening literally. And then with the exhalation, breathe it back out. Your deep station now is in the region of the heart, behind the body. Your inhalation draws the world you are now seeing into the heart. The exhalation releases it. If you've noticed your attention moving outward from the heart, gently draw it back. If you feel drawn to close your eyes, please do that. And now feel that with the inhalation, you're drawing the memory of that vision that you just saw with your eyes open. You're drawing that into the heart, and with your exhalation, you're allowing it to release. See if you can feel how this heart space is also a space of awareness. That the energy, the Shakti within the breath, actually caresses this heart space, softens and opens, and that as you draw in the so-called outside world, you can begin to feel as though your heart, which is filled with awareness, intelligence, that your heart holds that portion of the world of which you are now aware. That there is really no inside or outside. That your heart holds your experience, including the sense of your body. Don't think about this too much. Just have the feeling that you're drawing all forms, all the forms that you're presently aware of into the heart. Letting yourself rest there, and then allowing it all to flow back outward, so to speak, with the exhalation. You are that awareness, present in the heart space. Holding the breath, holding the experience of embodiment, holding the room, breathing all the forms into the heart and releasing them with the exhalation. Always being attentive to allowing awareness to to be expansive and free. And if you feel yourself trying, efforting, just remind yourself, soften. Before you open your eyes, again, be very, very present to the inner space of the heart. And hold this thought, everything within my field of experience. Is made of particles of awareness condensed into forms, and all of it is made of God, is made of Shakti, is made of Bhairava. And with your attention in the heart, open your eyes with the intention to recognize whatever I see, hear, whatever comes into the field of attention is made of God, which is also the awareness that allows it to be known. All this is Vaibhava. All this is my awareness. I'm going to ask you to hold that thought for 10 seconds fully. All this is God. All this is my awareness. Now you don't have to let it go, but I know that some of you are just going to stay in this awareness because there's been an emergence. But for those of you who are not completely plunged into Vaibhava consciousness, just see if you can keep your attention in the heart space and continue to breathe in what you're seeing with your open eyes, or maybe your eyes aren't open, my voice and the sense of the presence of all of us. Just continue to breathe it in to the heart and out. And I'm going to ask you if there's anyone who would like to share your experience about what we just practiced, or ask a question. And I'm going to ask you for now to ask questions having to do with what we've been discussing tonight. You can press star 2 to raise your hand, and Deb will call on you. And in the meantime, let's stay rooted in the heart, inhaling and exhaling this shared experience. Each of us present to the individual node of the heart. And Deb, who's raised their hand?
It doesn't look like we have anybody.
Okay.
Yet.
It's fine. We'll just be present here in silence for a moment and allowing anyone who has something you'd like to say about this meditation or anything you'd like to ask, the opportunity to do that. And again, you can, if something occurs to you, you can raise your hand, press star 2. And in the meantime, we're going to continue.
We just had somebody from Hawaii just raised your hand.
Raised their hand? Okay.
Yep. So, can you hear me, or do I type?
No, we can hear you.
Oh, okay.
You're on.
Great. So when we started this meditation, it flashed me back to a moment just after the first class when I was walking through nature and I was being aware of what was aware. And I had that feeling of seeing everything really fuzzy and alive, including the air.
Mm.
And so when you mentioned it at the start of this meditation, I was understanding what you're talking about, but now this time while I'm doing the meditation, I am looking at a door and inanimate objects. So I found that it was kind of difficult to bring that same idea to something that in my previous experiences is not alive.
Right.
And so I guess I'm just having a little bit of a hard time wrapping my brain around that idea.
I know it's much easier to see consciousness in the natural world than it is to see consciousness in the desk and the door.
Yeah.
I completely get it. And so what we can consider when, you know, when we're doing this practice and it's not happening, it's not revealing itself, is that what you're doing is practicing.
Right.
You know, it's and so sometimes it's a practice and it doesn't feel real. But simply by practicing, it softens, and you might notice that if you look, you know, if you're looking, again, if your attention has left the heart space, see if you can inhale back into the heart space. And
so
I also
noticed that the door is open and there are some things behind the door. And I notice that the things behind the door sort of jump.
Mm-hmm.
So I just need to tune more into that feeling or that awareness.
Yes. Just tune into, first of all, really stay present in the inner space, because that really is the heart of this practice, is to center yourself in the back heart, you know, in the inner, you know, inside, as
right.
we call it, and then let your gaze come from that place. And I get what I'm going to ask you is, do the objects feel softer, less different than you?
Yeah.
Do you see what I mean? Yeah.
Yes, I do. They want, it's funny because they want to be alive. The feeling of them wanting to be consciousness. I feel that feeling. I guess it's just a matter of continuing to practice that.
Yeah. It's just a matter of letting yourself notice the softening that occurs in your vision when you're looking from the inner heart with the awareness that consciousness actually can reveal itself as being part of inanimate objects. And you're right. It's like that wanting is part of the opening of your vision, that recognition that wood and plastic and metal, you know, have a very, their consciousness is much more dormant, you know, than it is in a tree. But it's there. And in a way, by being willing to look at the world from within, it's like you're lending your consciousness to, from one point of view, you're lending your consciousness to the inanimate. but from another point of view, by recognizing or by being willing to recognize the objects around you as potentially experienceable as part of your own consciousness, you're waking up the physical world.
Okay,
the human made physical world. The natural world is already awake.
Right.
But the chair is too, and we. So yeah.
It.
So play with it, and thank you
I
for
will,
asking.
Yeah. Yes, I had the feeling with a street sign the other day, looking at it, and it had a personality, and I really connected with that. But then now today, for some reason, I was having trouble. So I understand now.
It comes and goes, and yet
our
attention. Our attention is what makes it start to wake up. So thank you. Does anyone else have something you'd like to share or a question?
We have some questions from the list or from the discussion. So Jane has asked, can you describe the subtle body with more detail, please?
Sure. This is a big subject, the subtle body. So I'm not gonna do the entire, the entire display, just the entire conversation, because we don't really have time. But the subtle body is an energetic body that's made of prana, that is of, of life force, of thoughts, and it interpenetrates the physical body. So, in other words, one way of understanding the subtle body, which many of us are familiar with because many of us have had Chinese medical treatments or Ayurvedic treatments, in Chinese medicine, the meridians that run through the physical body that are actually energy channels are parts of the subtle body. And what the sages of all these traditions understood is that the subtle body, that is the energetic body, is actually prior to the physical body. We now understand that your thoughts and emotions affect you physically. The movement of energy in your body can get blocked, and that if we can move it, which is what acupuncture does, it will affect your state of health. So all of these are expressions of what the subtle body does. And in the subtle body, or the channels of the subtle body are not just inside the physical body. They also surround it at a distance of about 3 feet on each side. So if you stretch out your arms, as wide as you can, you create a kind of a sense of the subtle body containing and being much larger than the physical body. And there's a kind of deep relaxation that you can start to experience when you recognize that you have a body that is not made of flesh. It's, you have a body that's made of energy and that's affected by thoughts as well as your thoughts, other people's thoughts, what you read, what you eat, etc., that all of these are actually affecting the subtle body and are felt through mood, through the rising and falling of energy, and that you can actually embody yourself in the subtle body. And it will vastly amplify the energy that you're able to practice with or to experience in your physical body. So that's a kind of beginning of this process. The nadis, the channels that we talk about in yoga, which they're supposed to be 72,000 subtle channels that run through the physical body. And also, and this is this is very critical in understanding the subtle body. They also connect outside the body. They connect us to each other. So, you know, when you have that sense that we're part of the field of this Sangham, what we're actually connected, what is connecting us are our subtle bodies, is this subtle energy field that we tap into when we join together in this community. And, you know, it's we can experience that subtlety as a physical sensation, but generally we experience it subtly. And it literally enlarges our experience of the subtle body to connect to others who are connecting to us with an understanding that we're all part of spirit, that we're all part of the vastness, that we're all part of the Shivaness. So thank you for that, Jane. Deb, is there, are there other questions from the webcast?
Yeah, I have another one here. Marion asks, I don't know how to word this, but have been thinking about and wondering, if all this is God and awareness, then physical death does not stop the awareness. And then she goes on to say,
yeah,
thank you for the blissful experience.
Oh, that's so thank you. Yeah, that intuition is exactly what the sages tell us. Death is only, it's only a, you know, as someone said, it's only walking into one room, from one room to another, because awareness is present in all states, which is pretty mind-blowing. And I have to say that when I was teaching the course on the path of life and death, which we did, many of you did with me in the winter, and some of you did with me in Europe a couple of months ago, I got very, very deeply present to this recognition that awareness continues, that there is no such thing, there really is no such thing as death. The body dies and decays, awareness doesn't. And that conviction that awareness survives death, which I think was a gift for me of immersing myself in the teachings of the after-death world, has been truly profound for me. And, you know, and I think for many of you also, that it starts to really take away our fear of dying. So Emmy was sharing on the listserv something that she experienced last week when, or, you know, in the last couple of weeks, while she was grieving about the sudden death of one of her former yoga teachers, a very beautiful teacher named Mati Ezrahi. And she said that, as you know, she had this recognition which came as an udyamo, as an upsurge from not as a mind-borne thought, no separation. And, you know, that's a very good example of how the truth surges up, especially in moments when we're very open, as we are when we're grieving. You know, so yeah, there is no diminution of awareness after death. Thank you. So, Deb, is there another question?
Karen asks, Sally, thank you so much for all you do for us and for what you've brought to my life. I'm so deeply grateful, especially today. Regarding the meditation we just did, I experienced the view around me as wrapping paper like a veil, and memories were washing through, and I had a distinct sense that the little resentments and judgments present in these memories were keeping me from experiencing more. I kept trying to soften and lift the paper or fold it, but just rested it with softening and straddling awareness. Do you have any suggestions for how to move through this in the future?
Yeah, I know just what you mean. Well, so clearly you're experiencing samskaras, the power of the accumulated matrika, you know, that takes the form of our samskaras and vasanas, the tendencies that we hold on to because we haven't fully processed experience. And my suggestion is that you you kind of widen your awareness so that you have the feeling that awareness actually holds the resentments as well. And if there's you know, let it hold the paper, which are, you know, it's a great description, because it's, you know, like in the physical body, we have the fascia, which is kind of a membrane that wraps the entire body, and I guess keeps everything inside. So our samskaras and our resentments, our memories, all the effects of, you know, of the emotions and experiences that we've identified with, you know, form a kind of wrapping that keep awareness from fully opening. And yet awareness transcends the wrapping of our samskaras. So if you just let your awareness be wide enough so that you become aware that the memories, the resentments, the feeling of being constricted is actually appearing inside awareness, that it starts to loosen the constriction that all these different impressions and identifications have. And I've found that this is, it actually dispels the resentments in a kind of a global way, so that you don't have to go in and deal with every one of them. Sometimes, some of them we do, you know, some of them we do have to process. But in general, awareness can dissolve them. So I just suggest you try that, and, you know, let us know how it is for you over the course of the next few days. So again, thank you for that actually quite riveting description. I want to go back to the next sutra, because we only have a few minutes. But I just decided that we will do a Q&A session, and I want to talk about it with Deb just to make sure that we can find a time that works for her schedule over the next 4 or 5 days, so that, you know, you can bring the questions that have come up, you know, and think of the questions that have come up, and we'll spend an hour doing Q&A at a separate time. So thank you, and happy Guru Purnima, and we're going to talk about Sutra 7 for a few minutes. Jagat Swapna Sushupta Pede Turiya Bhoga Sambhavaha, which is, like so many of these sutras, can be interpreted in different ways, but the commentator, Kshema Raja, basically interprets it like this. So even during the three different dualistic states of consciousness, that is, open-eyed wakefulness, dreaming, and deep sleep, the experience of awareness remains. And what Kshema Raja says in explaining this is that an enlightened being, you know, a person who has really experienced the upsurge of Bhairava consciousness, the awakened experience of having the underlying awareness surge up and take over, someone who has really cultivated that begins at a certain point to experience pure non-dual consciousness all the time. So my guru once asked him, how do you describe the state you're in? And he said, my state transcends the mind and the senses, and in that state I swim in the ocean of bliss. And then he said, sometimes I come out of it, but I know how to get back to it. And what I felt he was saying was that, you know, for everyone, including enlightened beings, that, you know, the deep meditative awareness of consciousness and bliss comes and goes. But what an enlightened being knows through his or her deep cultivation is how to notice when you've left awareness, or let's say left the heart, and then how to return to it. So one interpretation of this sutra is that in the state of enlightenment, you are in a permanent, you permanently experience your own consciousness as the source of everything. And I would say there's another interpretation, which is true for all of us, which is what I would, you know, maybe we can call it the norm core experience of pervading consciousness. And that is that awareness is present in the waking state. It's present in dreams, and it's present in deep sleep, even though we're generally not aware of it in deep sleep. Awareness is present in all states. And, of course, that's why pure awareness can surge up in meditation and take over. It's like the awareness that underlies all experience, which is normally in the background, can come into the foreground. And the sutra uses this word, which some of you are familiar with, but for those of you who aren't, I want to introduce it because it's a useful term, like Shiva and Shakti, that's helpful to be familiar with. And that experience is Turiya. Turiya, it's the fourth word in the sutra. Turiya literally means the fourth, meaning the fourth state, the state that transcends waking, dream, and deep sleep. And again, for those of you who are familiar with the Indian philosophical tradition, Turiya describes the experience that arises in deep meditation. You know, when you feel yourself sinking or rising, when, you know, your thoughts stop taking up all the space in your consciousness, and there's, you know, when the Sushumna Nadi opens, which is often how this happens for me, and you actually feel yourself in an altered state, in a meditative state. For many of you, this is a fairly regular experience. Some of you go into it every day, others not every day, but enough so that, you know, you can say that, you know that there is this meditative awareness that is available to you, and that has the qualities of peace, it has the quality of expansion. It may not be thought-free, because we can experience Turiya even when thoughts are going on, but it's not at the affect of thinking. It's not, consciousness is no longer filled with thinking, even though thoughts might arise. Consciousness is open, peaceful, aware, present, often at the very least contented, and sometimes ecstatic. So this subtle, vibrant, calm, awake experience, meditative awareness, is what's called Turiya. And, you know, we often have fairly shallow experiences of it for a while, during our practice, kind of like, you know, wading in the ocean. We wade in Turiya in meditation. And usually it disappears when we come out of meditation. In fact, there is a whole science that the Shaiva sages talk about how you come out of meditation. So one of the ways that we can cultivate open-eyed meditative experience is to become very aware of what meditative awareness feels like with closed eyes, and to begin to turn back to it, first in memory, secondly in cultivation, from time to time during open-eyed meditation. And, one of the reasons why I emphasize so much the open-eyed walking around practice is because they will tend, if you do them regularly, if you spend a little time bringing your attention to the heart or reminding yourself everything is being experienced by my awareness, everything is Shiva and I am that, all the different enlightened thoughts or internally focused attention that we practice during the day begins to cultivate more and more this recognition that your awareness, you know, that capacity for knowingness that allows us to experience everything is actually I'm looking for the right word, is actually available to us because it is ever present and its nature is awareness. And you know, it is, as we said earlier, quoting Adyashanti, your common or garden variety awareness is not really different from the ultimate awareness. It's just contracted. It's just miniaturized. Its creative powers are somewhat limited, but it is actually the same subtle creative intelligence at the source of everything. And the more you can make a commitment to being aware of awareness, the more you start to notice that it really is always present, that there is this witnessing consciousness which is just accompanies every experience of life, and it actually is the container, the field, the screen of experience. So as we go into meditation for just a few moments, have the intention to make awareness, as we have been doing throughout the class, to make awareness the focal point of your attention. Even as thoughts are arising and subsiding, even as different moods are present, just let yourself be aware of that which is aware, that your eyes are open or closed, that you're sitting or walking, that you're listening, that you're focusing internally. Just let your attention linger on itself, letting yourself be aware of awareness. This is your open-eyed, so to speak, ordinary entrance into Turiya, which is always present as the underlying awareness that knows your life. So you notice that in these first sutras, what the sutras are doing and what we're doing is looking at awareness from different perspectives, different points of view. So, you know, we have this neuronal wiring, which the sages tell us has been put in place by the Shakti as part of her active concealment, and which, of course, we experience as a physical, I like to call it an array. There's a physical array of neurophysiological responses that seem to be centered in the brain, in the back of the brain, and which pattern our observations, pattern our awareness such that we see the world as being distinct and different rather than seeing it as it is, which is a moving field of energies constantly interacting. In other words, what scientists see through the microscope as the quantum field, which has led them to recognize that there is actually one energy that is appearing as all the distinct, so-called distinct objects of the world. You know, we have this neuronal patterning which shows us distinction. And yet, the awareness which knows no distinction is present even when experience seems very, very sharp and distinct, showing us a world that seems to be outside of us and is not always that much fun to experience. So as we keep turning to awareness and asking to be shown the truth about ourselves and meditating regularly, because this really is very important. It is our meditation practice, which cooks consciousness in higher states, in deeper states, in more thought-free states, that as we practice and as we ask for grace, little by little, the sharpness of the inside-outside duality begins to dissolve. And we start to have this recognition that, yes, the world is somewhat different than me, but also somewhat the same. We begin to have what this text calls the dual non-dual experience, where, yes, there's duality, but also not entirely. And this is the way in which the Turiya state, which is essentially the recognition of the basic non-duality of experience, a recognition of awareness as pervading everything. This is how the Turiya state starts to become more and more familiar, and eventually starts to become part of your daily experience. I mean, it doesn't necessarily show up initially as, you know, as a removal of the veils. Often it shows up as a deeper relaxation, or as an ability to feel your own innate happiness, so that life starts seeming sweeter. This is obviously an effect of meditation. What it really is, though, is the effect of your increasing familiarity with your own fourth state of consciousness, the Turiya state, whose nature is awareness, which is present throughout your experience of waking, dreaming, and deep sleep. So let's meditate for just a couple of minutes. With our attention in the heart, as we have been doing, bringing your awareness with the breath, following the breath into the heart space and behind the heart, and letting your attention settle there. Close your eyes. And with awareness focused in the heart space, in the back heart, be aware of that alive energy, that alive knowingness, which allows you to be present right now. Can you let that felt sense of awareness and presence fill your heart space? Can you activate the sense of awareness such that you recognize for a moment that every sensation in your body, every thought that arises, all the sounds, all the feelings, are all being held in that awareness? And let yourself rest in the back heart. The region of the open, aware, conscious heart space. And we'll sit in that. For just a moment. And then go on with our evening or our day. Thank you so much for being here and for offering your presence and awareness into this space that we share. Thank you to our gurus and to the great guru who awakens us to the truth of the heart and the truth of the self. And the truth of that awareness which connects us to the heart of the universe and each other. Have a beautiful evening and a beautiful week. Happy Guru Purnima. So much love.
मनोबुद्ध्यहंकारचेतानि नाहि न च श्रोत्रजिह्वे न च घ्राणनेत्रे न च व्योमभूमि न तेजो न वायु चिदानन्दरूपं शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं चिदानन्दरूपं शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं न च प्राणसंज्ञो न वै पञ्चवायु न वा सप्तधातु न वा पञ्चकोशा न वा पाणिपादं न चोपस्थपायु शिवानन्दरूपा शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं चिदानन्दरूपा शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं न मे द्वेषरागौ लोभमोहौ मदो नैव मे नैव मात्सर्यभाव न धर्मो न चार्थो न कामो न मोक्ष चिदानन्दरूपा शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं चिदानन्दरूपा शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं न पुण्यं न पापं न सौख्यं न दुःखम् न मन्त्रो न तीर्थं न वेदा न यज्ञा अहं भोजनं नैव भोज्यं न भोक्ता चिदानन्दरूपा शिवोऽहं
चिदानंद रूपा शिवोहं शिवोहं अहं निर्विकल्पो निराकार रूपो विभूत्वाच्च सर्वत्र सर्वेन्द्रियाणां न चासंगतं नैव मुक्तेन मे चिदानन्दरूपा शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं चिदानन्दरूपा शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं चिदानन्दरूपा
न वेदा न यज्ञा
Aham bhojanam naiva bhojyam na bhokta chidananda yupa shivoham shivoham chidananda rupa shivoham shivoham aham nirvikalpo nirakara rupo vibhutvacha sarvatra sarvendriyana nacha sangatam naiva muktena meya chidanam rupa shivoham shivoham chidananda rupa shivoham shivoham chidananda rupa shivoham chidananda rupa shivoham 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 shivoham. Mano buddhyahankara chintani naha nacha shrotha jihve nacha ghrana netre nacha vyoma bhumi na tejo na vayu chidananda rupa shivoham shivoham chidananda rupa shivoham shivoham nacha prana sangyo na vai pancha vayu na va sattadhakur na va pancha kosha na va pani padam na chopastha payu chidananda rupa shivoham shivoham chidananda rupa shivoham shivoham name dvesha ragau lobhamohau mado naiva me naiva matsalya bhava na dharmo na chartho na kamo na moksha chidananda rupa shivoham shivoham chidananda rupa shivoham shivoham. न पुण्यं न पापं न सौख्यं न दुःखं न मन्त्रो न तीर्थं न वेदा न यज्ञा अहं भोजनं नैव भोज्यं न भोक्ता चिदानन्दरूपा शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं चिदानन्दरूपा शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं अहं निर्विकल्पो निराकाररूपो विभूत्वाच्च सर्वत्र सर्वेन्द्रियाणां न चासङ्गतं नैव मुक्तेर्न मे चिदानन्दरूपा शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं चिदानन्दरूपा शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं चिदानन्दरूपा चिदानन्दरूपा शिवोऽहं 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 शिवोऽहं